Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chi Manchu, and today I'm with my friends Sam and Joan. Hey, guys.
Hey, Chris.
Hey.
So our guest tonight is Dr. Stevie Green to discuss topics on obesity medicine. But first, Sam, do you want to remind us what the podcast is all about?
I would love to. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Stevie Green. Dr. Green is a pediatric endocrinologist here at the Johns Hopkins Children's Center. She is board certified in pediatrics, pediatric endocrinology, and obesity medicine, and specializes in providing care to children with elevated weight and metabolic syndrome conditions. She directs the Fit and Healthy Kids Multidisciplinary Clinic at Kennedy Krieger Institute, a clinic designed to treat elevated BMI in children with physical and cognitive differences and disabilities, in addition to directing the Healthy Families Group at the Johns Hopkins Children's Center, a multidisciplinary intensive lifestyle therapy program for children with obesity and their families. Dr. Green teaches us about pediatric obesity management, and there's a lot to cover in this. We discussed lifestyle therapy in our episode number 59, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and today we'll focus more on medications, specifically updates on GLP-1s. And so if there's more interest in medication management to treat elevated BMI with non-GLP-1s, we'll make another episode.
Sounds good. Hello, Dr. Green. Thank you for coming on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Since we're sort of an informal group, is it okay if we go by your first name? Is that right, Stevie?
Of course.
Excellent. We just started to get warmed up at the beginning of most of our episodes so that our listening audience can understand, get to know our guests a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. So I'm a pediatric endocrinologist. I am constantly in search of a minimally toxic lifestyle. Think twice weekly baking with chickpeas and bananas to make cookies instead of sugar, and a silicone baking tray. My husband is the ex-chef. He critiques said baking regularly. And my favorite thing to do is spend time with my kids.
So one of our favorite questions that we like to ask on the show is, what is the best advice you've ever received, either as a learner or as a teacher or in your career?
Perfection is the enemy of good. This is something I really have to live by. It's harder to be a perfectionist nowadays because I'm limited on time. So that has helped a lot with that issue of mine. But truly, I think, you know, you don't have to be perfect to make progress.
Mm-hmm. I need to learn that lesson.
I know, we're all striving to achieve, and that's why we ask some of these questions. But we have a ton to talk about today, and we are in a grand round, so we do want to try to be as efficient as possible. So we might just jump into the case, if Joan, you want to take it from here.
Hey, Cribsiders listeners, whether this is your first episode or you've been with us since day one, you know our goal has always been to share real wisdom about practicing medicine. So let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day as a hospitalist, and that's fig scrubs. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in fig scrubs, and I get it, I wear them too. They're incredibly soft, form-fitting, and durable, and it's not just dust. If you've been watching a certain popular ER drama on TV, yep, they're in figs too. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and what keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids and kids come with messes, I love that figs are antimicrobial. When stuff gets on your scrubs, and it will, you just wash them and they come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine well over 50 times and they still look brand new. All of that and so much more is why we've teamed up with figs. Now, Cribsiders listeners can get 15% off. Just go to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX. That's WEARFIGS.com and use code FIGSRX for 15% off.
So here is our case from Cashlack Children's. So you meet Lyra, an 11-year-old girl, for a new patient well-child visit. She recently moved to the area and is establishing care. She's in sixth grade, enjoys art and reading. Her mother accompanies her to the visit. On exam, Lyra's height is at the 60th percentile, and her BMI falls at the 90th percentile for age and sex. Her vital signs are within normal limits, including blood pressure in the normal range for age. There are no other notable physical exam findings. When weight is brought up during the visit, her mother says, "She's just built this way. Everyone in her family is." Family history is notable for type 2 diabetes in her maternal grandmother and hypertension in both parents. As a provider, there's a delicate balance in understanding that you can be healthy at every size and that there's this correlation between obesity as well as elevated lipids and blood pressure. So as we mentioned in our previous episode on weight management, we discussed not focusing on numbers, but rather being healthy at every size. So our first question is, as an obesity medicine provider, how do you frame this discussion with patients and guardians?
So this is a very delicate conversation, and I think it's one of the most important ones throughout the visit that we have. I come to this discussion with families actually at the very end of my visit instead of starting the visit off this way. But I will use labs, vital signs, menstrual regularity, and assessment of comorbidities to really help guide my understanding of that unique person, because as you said, you can be healthy at many different sizes. And I'll also use the trend of BMI. So where is the BMI headed? Is it stable? Is it rising? Is it trending down to help guide that conversation as opposed to just the BMI percentile number? I actually start by asking, is it okay if we look at the growth chart? And that's probably one of the more important questions in our visit. And once I've gotten permission, I actually start with the height chart instead of the BMI or weight chart, which can be a very triggering spot to start. So we start with height, which is always actually a fun conversation. So we'll start off by just introducing them to the growth chart. Some families have not seen growth charts before. Some of the pediatric practices may not have a computer in the room. They may not have seen that. Mm-hmm. And so you have to walk them through. Here's age. Here's the height. Here's the growth percentiles. Why do we use the percentiles? What do we expect the trends to look like? And then I'll talk about if you're above, you can see that all of these different percentiles are associated with a healthy height. And everybody's different. We're all different sizes. But if you're above this curve or below this curve, it might trigger us to wonder, is there something going on? And look further into it. And it may not be. It may be a perfectly healthy height for that person. But it's just a screening tool for us to look and see, is there something more going on here? Do we need to look into it? So that's how I frame that first part of the conversation. And then I'll ask, what determines your height? They'll think about it, and sometimes they'll say sleep. Sometimes they'll say nutrition, but usually they'll come to the conclusion of genetics. And so once they say that, I say, that's exactly right. Now, there are things we do that impact our height, right? Like getting adequate nutrition. If you don't get enough vitamin D or zinc, or you don't get enough sleep, or there's stress on your body, your height may be impacted. But mostly it's genetics. And then I ask, what determines your weight? And then they pause, and they're a little silent, and then we sort of get to mostly genetics. You don't get to choose the number on the scale. So let's take a look at the BMI chart. And we try to go to the BMI chart instead of the weight chart because obviously your weight trend or your what's considered a healthy weight is going to be very different based on how tall you are. And so I explained that too, that the BMI sort of combines your weight and height together because if you're this tall, we expect the weight to be something than if you're this tall. So I try to jump immediately to the extended BMI chart as well if you have somebody that has severe obesity so that they get a placeholder on the line and they're not just floating out into the non-percentile land. So we jump to the extended BMI chart and we've already talked about what the growth chart means. So then I say, if somebody has obesity, we start with anything above this 95th percentile line is considered at risk for XYZ. You fill in the comorbidities you think are applicable to that family. So that's why we're here today, and I want to talk about that. And if they've not gotten lab assessment yet, that's a great time to say we should look at these things. But I also think it's important to say during that part of the conversation, I have kids I work with that are up here on the BMI chart pointing to somewhere above the 95th that are perfectly healthy and doing wonderful. And I have kids that are down here on the BMI chart that have medical conditions. So it's not just about the number here, but it's about who you are as an individual. So let's check the labs plus whatever comorbidity assessment we did. That tells us how your body's doing. And then we can have a conversation more about what we need to do. Does that make sense to you? And that's sort of how the conversation gets going. And so really important during the course of that conversation, again, to sort of orient them to the growth chart in a very kind way, orient them to that they don't control the number on the scale. There's certain things we do that impact it, but they don't choose the number, and that you can be healthy at many different sizes. That's the beauty of the human race. So those are really key points that need to be brought up during that conversation.
So one quick question is, so in our case, we have an 11-year-old. Are there any different nuanced ways you approach the patient and their families if they were later adolescents, or as a general pediatrician, maybe a little younger for some of us that were taking care of our patients. We might be seeing them earlier and seeing them sort of veer that way on the growth curve.
So that's another reason it's really nice to bring up the growth curve, because it's hard to explain to family the percentile is rising. And so that's a great time to bring up the growth chart, regardless of the age, and say, I'm a little bit concerned because the trend is rising and that where we're headed. So if we intervene now, we have a little bit more of an opportunity. In terms of age and how to approach the patient, this is the nice thing about being a pediatrician and having that training, is that you approach each age group very differently. So I'm not going to have the conversation with the two-year-old about the growth chart, but at 5, we sometimes are. And at 10 or 11, we definitely are looking at the growth chart together. I bring them over to the computer. We have that interaction because I'm going to be their doctor for a long time, just like a general pediatrician. And this is about them and their body. And they are very aware of what's going on. So you don't want to have that conversation just with parent if the child's able to engage with you. So I'm trying to look at both parent and child about 50% of the time and orient them into that. And again, I think that they understand a lot more than sometimes we think they do. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
So moving on with her case then, at her follow-up visit, Lyra and her mother report that they've made several changes. They started walking together after dinner 3 to 4 nights a week, and Lyra now helps pick out vegetables at the grocery store, and she will eat a few that she likes, like carrots and cucumbers. Sugary drinks have been cut back, though not eliminated, and despite these efforts, Lyra's BMI has now increased above the 95th percentile. So children are understandably growing, which we were alluding to just now. Their bodies are changing. And I know at my well-child visits, I try to focus on lifestyle interventions and counseling. But at what point do you really bring up medications for your patients?
So we'll start with what the AAP recommends, and then we'll sort of branch out to opinions. So the AAP recommended a few years back that we be starting in the general pediatrics clinics and subspecialty clinics anti-obesity medication starting at 12 and up for kids that have obesity, and considering it in 8 to 11-year-olds. And a lot of these recommendations come out of the fact that intensive lifestyle therapy can be therapeutic for some, but as patients get older, as the obesity becomes more severe, those intensive lifestyle therapy, even when done correctly, even when done 26 hours a year or over 3 months, which is what the recommendation is, become less and less effective. And so the watchful waiting has been shown to not be an effective therapy for most people. So as an example, for a younger child, let's say in this case, we have a fairly young child, the BMI is not severely elevated, there might be a 40 to 70% chance that intensive lifestyle therapy improves the BMI by about 3 to 5%. Not a huge difference, but clinically significant for some. As she gets a little bit older, as the BMI crosses into class 2, class 3, that becomes less effective. So we're looking at maybe 2 to 20% efficacy in some studies. It depends on which study you look at. So that's why the anti-obesity medications have become so critical and so important. We have now tools that we can use to help that people get to a healthy BMI and either put comorbidities into remission or reduce the risk of comorbidities. The medication start time is highly individualized, so I can't give you a set criteria because I don't think that one exists. In my practice, and this is my opinion now moving from the AAP guidelines, is that if you have class 2 or class 3 obesity, we're usually talking about pharmacotherapy start early on. If you have class 1 obesity and the BMI is very stable, it's not rising, you're doing healthy lifestyle modifications, you have zero comorbidities, and I ask a lot of questions to try to find comorbidities, and you have zero, I'm less inclined to start pharmacotherapy. I think the long-term risk of these medications is not fully drawn out yet. So it's a risk-benefit analysis. And if I can't find a reason that you really should be starting, I will tend to watch or wait a little bit longer, especially if there's no family history of diabetes or no other reason. So to summarize, if you have class 2 or class 3 obesity, or you have class 1 or lower with a comorbidity, I'm pretty likely to offer pharmacotherapy at that point.
Chris, I know you have another question. Just let me just really quickly, I just want to make sure we define class 1, class 2, class 3 obesity really fast. Would you mind just for our audience who may not have listened to our episode from a long time ago, just describe the difference of those, and then Chris will jump in with the next question.
Yeah. So, and people under the age of 18, class 1 obesity is the 95th percentile on the BMI chart and up. Class 2 is 120% of the 95th and up, and class 3 is 140% of the 95th and up.
All right. So One question I have is, so we're looking at these patients, possibly considering medications, which a lot of this episode is going to be about. So as you approach the patient, can you tell me how you talk to the patient and the family about thinking about medicines? Because I do know if they've done intense lifestyle therapy and they haven't got the results that everyone's wanted, it can be sort of demoralizing. And also, I think a lot of patients may blame themselves, or the parents may blame themselves for not being able to accomplish this. Can you say, if I was a parent, how would you discuss, you know, how would you approach talking to them saying, hey, it's not your fault in terms of not being able to reach the goals, maybe some reasons why they may not have reached the goals and why we think medications are the next choice. Can you walk that through?
So maybe we'll take it three things that we need to talk about. So in terms of the lifestyle modifications, if they have made a successful lifestyle change, like less juice or more fruits or more veggies, or even just doing 5 minutes of exercise that week, more than they were doing before, I give them a huge congratulations of that is so awesome. You have helped your body. Even if you don't see that change on the scale, your internal health has changed. And I know this, I tell them this, I know this because I am checking people's labs. And in kids that I treat with type 2 diabetes, when they change their juice intake or their sleep habits or their exercise, I see their numbers change even when the scale doesn't. So I know that your internal health is really benefiting from those changes. So keep them up. It takes time. It takes a lot of changes slowly over time. Just because the number on the scale didn't change doesn't mean you're not impacting your health positively. The other thing we got to talk about is when we first came in, we talked about the BMI curve and we talked about that that's impacted by genetics. And so I like to use my hands to talk to people. So I know you can't see this, but imagine. So I sort of use my hand to say, if your metabolism is sitting here and it's lower and your appetite is sitting above that, and I'm not saying your appetite is higher or lower, I'm just saying if your metabolism is sitting a little bit lower than your appetite and your appetite's sitting here, that over time leads to this dysregulation and over time leads to excess gain and can make it hard to get to healthy weight. So even when you lower your calorie intake or you make your diet more nutritious, sometimes because the way the body is designed, the metabolism goes down too to really maintain your BMI. And that is a natural thing that happens in the body, but sometimes that isn't good for our health. And when that happens, what we can do is use a medication to sort of re-regulate that metabolism, either bring the metabolism up or bring the appetite down so that they match. So when you are making those lifestyle changes, they become more impactful and more sustainable. Does that make sense to try one of those medications? And then you can go into sort of what the medications are. So I think it's a gentle conversation, and it takes place over time. So it starts with that initial visit talking about the dysregulation in metabolism. So then when you need to have that conversation, they already know there are other options available to me. I think I mentioned there was three things, but I guess I said two.
This was perfect. I'm already sold and I'm about to start these medicines. So Chris, you had the next question though.
All right. So GLP-1 agonists have shown exceptional efficacy in adults. Yeah, I spent a lot of times in my outpatient adult clinic, and it's been FDA approved for both diabetes and the weight loss. So as of 2026, which one of these are FDA approved for children?
So semaglutide under the brand name Wegovy. So semaglutide comes in two forms, Wegovy and Ozempic, but under the brand name Wegovy, it is FDA approved for children 12 and up, and that's been going on for a few years now. Saxenda was approved even before that. Saxenda is liraglutide, but under the brand name Saxenda. So you get to higher dose than you would with the type 2 prescription for children, and that's also approved for 12 and up under the brand name Saxenda. I wanted to mention here, because I use a lot of off-label GLP-1s, and I think people need to know what they have access to, because you may not get a weight management covered GLP-1. So it's important to know what else is on the market. So Zepbound, or in this case, tirzepatide, under the brand name Mounjaro, is actually now approved for kids with type 2 diabetes 10 years and up. So if you have somebody that you could maybe get Mounjaro for, that might be a better option in some cases. There's also a whole list of GLP-1s that are approved for 10 years and up for type 2 diabetes in children. Those are not as effective at BMI change, so I don't think we need to go into those. But so those are the three that you're looking at. Saxenda, which is liraglutide, Wegovy, which is semaglutide, and then Mounjaro, which is tirzepatide. That also has another brand name, but not approved in kids yet.
Gotcha. So with your your crystal ball looking in the future, what do you think we're going to see available for children in the future? Are they all going to be 12 and up, or will we see maybe some testing, any studies in looking at any of these medications for younger? And then we're only a couple of weeks out from the Super Bowl, and during the Super Bowl, there were lots of advertisements for an oral version of semaglutide. So are you able to speak to any of that?
Sure. So semaglutide under the brand name Wegovy is now available in an oral pill form, but it's only 18 and up at this point. So do I think that will extend down to kids at some point? Yeah, that is typically how the pattern goes, is that it gets approved in adults, and then sometime thereafter, 3 to 5 to 10 years later, it gets approved in kids. Same thing with Zepbound using tirzepatide under the brand name Zepbound for weight management, I'm hoping that is eventually coming to kids. Now that we've used the medication for type 2 diabetes in kids, I'm hoping they'll expand the use to weight management at some point. In terms of the age cutoffs, so there have been studies, not clinical trials necessarily, but studies looking at GLP-1 use in 6 to 12-year-olds, and that was shown to be safe and effective. And so some providers will argue with insurance companies in an extreme case that they need to be using that GLP-1 and that it was shown safe and effective using that study. So hopefully eventually there will be some clinical trials done so then it can get FDA approval for a younger age group.
So it's interesting. These are some of the drugs that the general public actually knows somewhat of the mechanism. You know, when you say, hey, take metoprolol, they might not know this is a beta blocker. But I feel like the word GLP-1 exists in the general public. But I think this is a good time for us to talk about how these drugs work. So if you wouldn't mind taking us through GLP-1, GIP, all of these things, and trying to explain to us kind of what you were trying to explain to your patient and how they work.
Sure. So semaglutide is the GLP-1, tirzepatide is the GLP-1 plus the GIP. So GLP-1 stands for glucagon-like peptide 1, and GIP stands for gastric inhibitory polypeptide. But both of these hormones are something your body naturally makes. It affects your gut, and so it slows down how quickly things move through your gut so that you feel fuller longer and satisfied more easily. But they also send a signal to your brain, and they actually work in the center of your brain that regulates appetite and metabolism to send a signal through just as if you've already eaten. And so that also helps decrease appetite at the level of the brain without necessarily taking a huge hit to metabolism. So that's mainly how they work. And because you're having less consumption and volume, that typically leads to calorie restriction, which leads to weight loss. But the other thing that changes is cravings for calorie-dense foods. So not only do you have lower volume intake, but often the types of foods have changed. So for instance, if you have somebody that's eating, and I'm using a real case scenario in my mind, I had a patient that was eating McDonald's twice in one meal, for example, and not a single vegetable, even though they'd been in an intensive lifestyle therapy for 3 to 4 years. And she knew to do these things, right? She just couldn't. She just wasn't in her wheelhouse. And we started Wegovy for her. And the next month I saw her, she said, I started eating a vegetable and I'm only doing McDonald's once a day. My cravings are just different. The foods I want are different. I'm able to make those smarter choices. So the cravings, the foods that we want change on these medications.
And just to follow up, so is the weight loss technically from lack of caloric intake, so to speak? What I'm trying to say is, like, when we think about weight gain loss, too much in, too much out, you know, you're using up too much and that type of thing. Is it mostly the fact that you are now taking in fewer calories from whatever your body is doing from an appetite perspective?
It is. So with calorie restriction, with lifestyle choices alone, for some people that is effective. But for a lot of people, and we talked about that, the percentage of people that will benefit from lifestyle only. For a lot of people, when they have the calorie restriction without a medication on board, the metabolism also drops. And we've seen that clinically, this has been well described. But with the medication on board, we don't necessarily see as drastic a metabolism drop. So that is why the calorie restriction leads to sustained and continued weight improvement.
These drugs sound quite effective, huh?
They are pretty effective. Pretty effective, not for everybody, but for many.
Actually, I do have one question about that. You said not for everyone. So are there people who are GLP-1 resistant?
Yes, definitely. In the studies, at least for Wegovy and kids, about 30% of people did not respond with a significant improvement. Actually, some people gained weight on Wegovy.
Do we have an idea on the mechanism of that?
I think the obesity phenotype is different in everybody. And some of this literature has been described in adults, but I see it clinically in the kids. And I actually try to apply some of the adult data to the kids I'm working with when I can. But I think everybody's body is very different. So I have some kids that I work with that I sort of put them in the slow burner category, right? They're the kids that are eating. And again, I'm using a case from my own clinical experience. I'm somebody that was eating grilled chicken, spinach, and a smoothie each day. And that was really it, maybe half a bagel. I mean, his parents confirmed this over many, many visits. And he was just a very slow burner. And him, I don't think Wegovy would have been safe. He was already eating a very low volume, and I don't think it would have been effective. For him, actually, an oral medication that focuses mainly on boosting metabolism, a little change in appetite, was the most effective treatment for him. So for him, using a small dose of phentermine worked wonders for him.
We're going to have to bring you back for another episode, because
yeah,
we got to talk about all those medicines.
I know,
too,
we don't
one
have enough
days.
Time to talk yes. about all the medicines, but Joan, you want to mind jumping on to the next one?
So when we start these medications, what are the side effects we want to make sure that we're counseling our patients to look out for? And is there any long-term lab monitoring that we should be doing?
So most common is nausea, and you really need to prepare your patients for that. I prepare them to say almost everybody will get nausea. I mean, maybe it's 80 to 90% clinically, but nausea happens most commonly with these medications within the first 12 to 48 hours after the weekly dose, because most of these are dosed weekly, except for Saxenda. So in that 12 to 48 hours, the nausea can be really severe, but for some people, it's very mild. And I would say most of the time, it's very mild when you are starting at low doses and going up very slowly. Sometimes I will prescribe Zofran for patients, especially to get through those initial dose changes or just to have on hand so they feel comfortable, because nausea is a very uncomfortable sensation. But I don't give them many because I want them to call me. I don't want them taking Zofran every single day to combat side effects. This may not be a good choice medication for them in that case. So I give them a few doses just to handle that. The next thing that can happen is you can have diarrhea or constipation. You can have fatigue or hair loss. You can have gallbladder disease or pancreatitis. All of those can occur and you need to watch for those. But by far the most common is the nausea, maybe followed by the constipation is what I see. In terms of other things we need to be mindful of in terms of with side effects is muscle mass loss. And this has been a hot topic lately. So there is significant muscle mass loss when the weight loss is occurring. And in order to help try to prevent that, it's really important that you talk about at the visits getting protein with every meal. I usually recommend 15 to 30 grams per meal or that amount over the time span of the day. And also resistance training. And so I try to have patients do at least 3 days a week of resistance training. And again, it's just like any other lifestyle modification. If they start with 5 minutes once a week, we'll go from there. But it is really important to talk about that at the visits. In terms of long-term lab monitoring, there's not something specific to the GLP-1s, but I will say that because there's a calorie restriction and some of their appetites can be quite low, we have to be really careful with the vitamins and mineral intake. And so I will often check vitamin D and iron, and then I get a nutrition history almost every visit. And so sometimes I'm able to tease out, hey, you're really not getting any vegetables. Let's check a folate. Or you're really not getting any source of vitamin C. We should check that. But almost all the patients, I have started them on a multivitamin with minerals to help prevent any nutrient deficiency that might occur.
You would do that empirically?
I do that
what.
Empirically. As soon as they start having a lower appetite, that's enough to be subnormal. That is when I'm starting the multivitamin. Or if their diet is quite poor and I can tell they're not getting enough fruits and vegetables, I'll start it as well.
And then going back to the nausea and constipation, are these things that get better with time or like as they get adjusted so we can counsel our patients?
Thank
like
you
that?
So much for asking, because I meant to say that. Yeah, so they do typically get better with time. For example, I had one patient that with their first dose of Wegovy of 0.25 milligrams had a week of really bad nausea and vomiting to the point where I was like, I don't think this is a good choice. But they really were like, let's just take some Zofran. I want to try it again next week. And then next week, actually, she didn't have any side effects. So they do get better with time. They also get better the slower you go. Mm-hmm. So if you're having some side effects, do not increase to the next dose level. You do not need to follow a manufacturer's guidance on 5 months getting to full dose. I have some patients that have effective dosing at 0.5 or even 0.25. So go slow, use their side effects to guide how frequently to go up, and use their appetite and changes in their weight to help guide as well.
Hey, Cribsiders listeners. On episode 135, we sat down with Dr. Tristan Nichols and talked about how AI is already changing how we practice pediatric medicine. From expanding differentials on tough cases to generating discharge instructions that families can actually understand. One thing that really struck with me is the idea that AI shouldn't replace our clinical reasoning. It should sharpen it. And that's exactly why I've been using Claude. Claude is the AI for minds that don't stop at a good enough. It's the collaborator that actually understands your entire workflow and thinks with you. Whether you're debugging code at midnight or strategizing your next business move, Claude extends your thinking to tackle the problems that matter. What I love about Claude for Medicine is its deep research capability. It goes way beyond a basic web search. I'm talking comprehensive analysis with proper citations, pulling connections across dozens of sources that I would never spot on my own. It's like having a research partner who never gets tired. Whether it's working through a tricky inpatient diagnosis, reviewing the latest management guidelines, or putting together a teaching topic for my residents, Claude helps me think deeper instead of just skimming the surface. So Cribsetters listeners, ready to tackle bigger problems? Get started with Claude today at claude.ai/cribsetters. That's claude.ai/cribsetters, and check out Claude Pro, which includes access to all the features mentioned in today's episode. claude.ai/cribsetters.
This is a perfect kind of transition. We're actually going to talk about dosing, because we kind of, one of our goals on these episodes here is to get kind of what you would do in your visit, and maybe we could start them ourselves and do those things. So we actually do like to know about dosing. So my question, and you kind of already mostly answered it, but we'll kind of start at the beginning. How do you dose these medications? And then the second thing is there a goal dose? And that comes down to like, okay, this study was done on this dose, and so therefore that's the goal, but I see that we could do less, you know, those types of things. So really, how do you dose these medicines so we could do it ourselves?
In general, for all medications, whether it be GLP-1s or orals, I am always starting at the lowest possible dose that I can. Sometimes I know it's going to be a subtherapeutic dose, and that's okay, because we want to avoid the side effect start. Once somebody gets a side effect on a medication, they're unlikely to want to try it again, and you're probably unlikely to prescribe it again. So start at the lowest possible dose. With Wegovy, the starting dose is 0.25 milligrams, and then you can increase as frequently as once a month. So it starts at 0.25, then 0.5, then 1. This is a weekly dose. So you get 4 pens in a box, and then they should be messaging you before they go get their next refill to say, is this a good dose? Should I continue at this dose, or should I go to the higher dose? And I usually give them a printout in the beginning of sort of a screenshot of what the pens look like, how long it's going to take to get to full dose if we need to get there. So then you go to the 1 milligram dose, then 1.7, and then up to 2.4 milligrams. But again, most of my patients aren't on 2.4 milligrams. They may have done well at 1.7 or 1. So you really have to base it on the patient's response. One caveat to that, if you go too slow to the point where they're not having any benefit in terms of BMI change, when it comes time to renew the prior authorization at 6 months for most insurance companies, they may kick them off the medication, because they'll say they haven't had any BMI change. Then you have to go in and explain, well, we didn't increase because they were having side effects. We had to go slower. They didn't start for a month, all of these things. So you do have to be mindful of that you want to see BMI change at the same time that you're reducing side effects. So it is a little bit of a balance, but I wouldn't use insurance coverage as a reason to increase if they're having side effects, but just be mindful of that.
Yeah. What about some of the other brands? We do like to keep ourselves, because we are a CME accredited podcast, yeah, try to be as universally accepting to all things that are FDA approved for this audience.
So for Saxenda, which is and I'm using the brand names because all of these generic forms come with a different brand name that's used for type 2 diabetes. So Saxenda, which is liraglutide, that dose is given daily, and you actually can titrate weekly. So you would start at 0.6, and then you go up to 1.2, and then 1.8 milligrams. And again, you can prescribe that in such a way that they're going to change the dose over the course of the month, or you can talk to them about, check in with me each week before you up titrate the dose. So that one, you need to give specific instructions to talk to you weekly to do that. Or on the monthly, where you're changing it every month, then you want to have them talk to you monthly. So usually the way I will do it is I will try to set up a virtual visit at that month time point. That's rare that I can get it right on the money at that 4 week mark. So maybe it's 6 weeks or so, but I have them message me through my chart, a weight check, a side effect check, and how they're doing. And that gives me enough guidance to change the dose if I need to.
And we've talked about this a little bit, but what are your goals for the patients in terms of the changes we're trying to see? Is it like changing, coming down in the percentile or a number, like a BMI number, or is it like other comorbidity changes that we're looking for?
So it's kind of all of that involved. And I should mention here that I avoid a specific target weight. I think that's a sort of triggering game for some people, because then when they get on the scale, they don't see that number on the scale. That can be challenging for them to see. And also, I don't think any provider could give somebody a specific weight number that's going to be their healthy weight. I think it's about change in BMI percentile. I think it's about change in comorbidities. I think it's about how they're feeling and how they're doing. And the other thing is, for a growing child, that even if you gave them a target weight, it's going to change every month. Mm-hmm. So it's really not a healthy practice, I don't think, to give a target weight in pounds. So the discussion I'll have with families is that try not to focus on the number on the scale. You don't need to check every day or every week. Check before that monthly check-in with me and just send it over. Don't talk about it. You don't need to say, oh, good job, or oh, you didn't lose any this week. Just send it over. It's just a vital sign check. And then I'll help you guys adjust the medication if needed to help with the number on the scale. But as we talked about, you don't control the number on the scale. It's going to be what it's going to be. You control your lifestyle choices, and I'll work with the medication. The other thing that we'll look at is, once you've had a 5 to 10% improvement in the BMI percentile, oftentimes comorbidities will be in remission. And so that's a great time point to sort of work. That's a great benchmark to try to work towards. But also, at that 5 to 10% improvement, you want to reassess the comorbidities if you haven't already. So is PCOS still going on? What is the ALT? What is the blood pressure? What's the sleep apnea doing? And if they're doing great at that 10% improvement in BMI and the comorbidities are in remission, that might be a great place for them to just hang out, and you don't need to push further for further loss. The other thing to mention is, in terms of, because I have had this happen with patients, is that they get to 20 or 25% improvement in BMI, and you ask yourself, should I keep giving the same dose? Should I back off? And it really depends on the patient and the severity of the BMI. So if they were starting out at class 3 obesity and with multiple comorbidities, a 20% improvement in BMI is probably a good spot for them to be if they're not having side effects. On the other hand, if they were starting off at class 1 obesity with a very minimal comorbidity and they had a 20% change in BMI, that's pretty drastic. We really need to assess at that point, are they getting enough nutrition? Are they getting minerals? Are they getting vitamins? Are they getting enough protein? So it varies per person.
And this is perfect. And I do have just a specific question about when you're titrating, or when you get that message back to you in a month, for example. So, like, say it's pretty easy to say, okay, you've seen zero change, but you have no side effects. So the risk-benefit profile to increasing your dose is good for increasing your dose. So great. That one I got. When you have lots of side effects and you can't increase your dose, that one I also have. My question is, what happens? What's your kind of choice when someone is showing weight gain at a kind of, we'll say, a low to moderate dose and has kind of no side effects? Are you like, let's just leave it here? And kind of how do you choose that? Or do you say, hey, let's go all the way up to the FDA approval dose, the max dose?
So this is where my job gets a little complicated.
Right, this is where we refer to you, but we're hoping to try to do something here. Yeah.
So a lot of this comes out of practice. Yeah. So when you practice using these medications with different patients and different side effects, you get a little bit more understanding of what's going to work best in that patient and for that family as well. So when they send that message back to you, when you see them for the follow-up visit, the thing you're looking for in the short-term changes is the scale on the change on the scale or change in percentile. So in general, and there are charts to sort of look at degree of BMI elevation and age, how much should they lose per month or per week? But in general, about 1 to 2 pounds a month for a very young child is okay. When you get into sort of the 8 to 10 to adolescence, 1 pound a week is a really safe place to be. And that's sort of what I like people to sit at, is about 1 pound a week. It's really slow, but you'll see when these kids come into clinic, it's actually really fast. And so 1 pound a week is a good gauge there. If they're going beyond 2 pounds a week, I'm usually pulling back the dose. Even if they're not happy with me when I do that, I'm saying it's really important to go slow. If we go too quickly, we risk complications of weight loss. So let's go slow and just keep things steady. So we'll pull back on the dose if they're losing too quickly. If they're not losing and their weight is stable, I say, if they were gaining before and now their weight's stable, that's a really good hint to you that this medication may actually be a choice for them. It's just not at the right dose. So let's say I started them out on a very low dose of, I know you guys want to talk about GLP-1s, but I have to mention a little bit of orals just because it's part of this conversation. So let's say we started off at a very low dose of phentermine, 8 milligrams, and their weight plateaued. They weren't gaining anymore. They're not having side effects. And you think they're sort of that slow burner, like they could really benefit from this phentermine. Then I might go to 15 milligrams. If they're a kid that they had a weight plateau, but they have a large appetite still, I might actually add on Topamax. So that's where you sort of play that game of adding on adjunct therapy. So if if they have not lost weight, but you think they may be benefiting from the medication, or they haven't benefited at all, but there's zero side effects, that's a great time to leave the medication on board and add an adjunct therapy. So in the case of GLP-1s, there's not really a second GLP-1 you add. That's a different class of medications. And most of the time with GLP-1s, we don't always have an adjunct. But for the oral meds, you're probably going to need to add an adjunct. Usually two medications on board is typical. So in the case of phentermine, I might add Topamax. If they're on Topamax, I might add phentermine. If they're having constipation, what a great time to add metformin, right? Because that's an adjunct therapy that may also help one of the side effects. So if you can find a medication that sort of balances out one of the side effects they're having, that's a great opportunity to do that. If they're on a GLP-1 already, the next step would just be to go up on the dose if they're not having side effects. And that's sort of an easier brain thing to do. It's like, okay, you're at the super low dose, go up on the dose, you're not having side effects, we'll go from there. If they're having constipation, that might be a time to add metformin again. Yep. So it is a challenge to do that part of the role, but my advice is go slow. It's okay to go slow and start low, because that's when you're going to have less side effects. And the one other piece is that it might be a better choice to have more medications on board at lower doses than to be at a super high dose of one medication alone, because you're going to risk side effects at that dose.
So I guess in my mind, I'm imagining, you know, patients on a good dose of GLPs, and they are, you're seeing that weight loss at the rate that you're looking for, and then they've kind of hit that goal rate. At that time, are we like dropping them down to a lower one because we want them to maintain that? Or I'm kind of curious about that.
That's a great question. So all of these medications are going to reach their own weight plateau anyway. They're not going to continue to lose forever. They will sort of reach that BMI set point where on that Wegovy of 2.4 milligrams, that's their set point. Or on that Wegovy of 1.7 milligrams, that's their set point. So if they've reached comorbidity remission and BMI has improved by 10 to 15 or even 20%, I don't usually pull back on the dose, because usually things are slowing down at that point. The only time I pull back on the dose is once they are in maintenance therapy. So they've been at a stable BMI percentile with no comorbidities for, let's say, 6 to 12 months. We might say, let's see if we can get away with a little bit lower dose for maintenance. Or if they're having side effects, I will pull back on the dose. Or if there's an insurance issue for whatever reason and we need to adjust dosing of multiple medications, we'll do that. But those are the only times I really pull back on the dose. You're either losing too quickly, we're trying to enter a maintenance phase because things have been really stable for a long time, or you're having side effects.
We kind of skipped this, and we probably should have done this in the earlier part when we talk about contraindications. So essentially, we should know, we talked, okay, these people are eligible, this is patient that we should put them on. We should probably know who is a contraindication. Who should we not be prescribing these medicines to, just at the baseline, so then we can kind of jump back into the conversation that we're having.
So for the GLP-1 agonist, which we'll focus on that because this otherwise would be too long, but a personal or family history of thyroid cancer should immediately alarm you to say, what type of thyroid cancer? Was it medullary thyroid cancer? They don't usually know. You might have to get them to do some family history digging. Or does anyone have MEN, multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome type 2? Because that would be a risk for medullary thyroid cancer. Pregnancy is another one you wouldn't want to start these medications in. And if they become pregnant, you need to adjust what you're doing. Hopefully that's not the case, but you might need to change what you're doing. And then if they've had pancreatitis, you need to be very cautious, because pancreatitis is a potential side effect of these medications. I personally would say it's not a true contraindication, because it depends on the cause of the pancreatitis. So let's say they had triglycerides of 600 and they got pancreatitis, but now the triglycerides are 150. Okay, maybe they're not at risk for pancreatitis. But if they have a chronic pancreatitis condition, this medication is not a good choice for them.
So my follow-up question is about contraindication, or maybe relative contraindication, is we know that eating disorders are underrecognized, especially in our adolescent population. Is this something you try to screen or assess for before you even think about talking about medications? And if so, is it complete contraindication, or if a patient's already set up with maybe an eating disorder expert working together with them in that regard?
Yeah, this is really tricky. So I do screen for eating disorders in the sense that I get a really thorough nutrition history. I ask about emotional eating. I ask about binge eating behaviors, night eating behaviors, these sort of things. But to be honest, not all of that will come out. Sometimes there might be a past history of binge eating disorder and it's not current, so they might not endorse that. So you do need to ask very specific questions to families and patients. But ultimately, a lot of times, some of these binge eating disorders in particular are actually a result of an underlying genetic metabolic dysregulation that they've been trying to control with lifestyle therapy and they haven't been able to. So they may be restrictive all day and then their hunger is very high and they have the binge eating at night. And so addressing the underlying metabolic dysregulation actually may help them control their eating behaviors. So you need to have that conversation with family and discuss, especially with GLP-1s. If somebody's on a GLP-1 and they eat a large volume, the result is going to be that they're probably going to have severe nausea and probably will throw up. And so you really need to say, listen to your body. Feel, is this mouth hunger you're having or belly hunger that you're having? And that's conversations we'll often have in clinic at some point anyway. And so helping them distinguish mouth hunger versus belly hunger can be a good way to practice mindful eating. And the other thing is, if you think there's an eating disorder going on, you absolutely need to refer to therapy. It can be hard to find a specialist, so you can start with just basic psychological therapy, which is usually what's underlying the eating disorder to begin with. In terms of what have studies shown, these types of medications actually reduce the incidence of disordered eating, probably for reasons I just discussed. You're sort of giving somebody a healthy, manageable tool to manage their weight instead of the unhealthy tools that they were employing before.
I have a slightly different question on a different wavelength. Just if you were to stop these medicines for whatever reason, would you need to wean the dose, or is this something that's given weekly? You say, all right, you don't take it next week and we're done, and it will slowly ooze its way out of your body.
It really depends on medication. For GLP-1s, if they're having a side effect, you could just stop it. They're not going to have a dependence on it, except to say they're going to notice their appetite goes way up. And so you need to counsel them about that. If they're not having a severe side effect and they just want to see if they can do weight management off of it, that would be a time that you would wean down slowly and say, let's see how things look at 1.7. Let's see how things look at 1. So you can do that, wean down slowly, but you want to have that super close follow-up. If it's a medication that is not a GLP-1, the only one that you have to be very conscious of weaning off is Topamax, because it's an anti-seizure medication. So any anti-seizure medication, you need to wean off slowly. But the others, if they're having a side effect, you could theoretically stop it. It's not going to harm their body, but their appetite may go quite high after that.
So along those lines, you know, there are lots of reasons why people may have issues with adherence. We're obviously dealing with an adolescent group. Also, insurance maybe has often been an issue when I've been prescribing these medications, where we're changing a dose and then we have to go through a prior auth again, or something happens and all of a sudden we're at a week and now we're at 2 weeks before they get their next dose. Can you describe any ways that you, is there anything special we need to do in those cases? Can we just resume the previous dose, or do we have to wean back down to a previous dose, or how do you go about addressing those types of issues?
So it depends on the medication you're on, but for GLP-1s, if there's a lapse in coverage that we know is coming, which sometimes they do, then I will say space out the dosing to 10 to 14 days. It buys us a little bit more time. If it's a clickable pen, which the semaglutide Wegovy is not right now, but some of the other GLP-1s that maybe you got off label might be. So if it's a clickable pen, I'll tell them to go to a lower dose and just stay at the lower dose for longer. In terms of getting insurance coverage, the initial prior authorization, all of them need a prior authorization. They will always be initially denied because they want you to fill out the paperwork to check the boxes. After the prior authorization, if it's denied, look at the reason why, because it may be an arguable reason. And the other thing is that if you have a person on Maryland Medicaid, for example, where, and I know this is not just in Maryland, but there's many, many states that have restrictions on the use of anti-obesity medications in that population, you might be able to argue with specific wording that the state law requires Medicaid provide the standard of care for patients. And these medications are now considered the clinical guideline is to prescribe them. They are the standard of care. So arguing using your own state's laws for that medication cover for a Medicaid patient may be helpful. And then sometimes you're able to argue in the non-state restriction candidate in the private insurance category about why they need that medication. You're fighting PCOS or, you know, severe prediabetes or very severe hypertension or severe OSA. All of these things you can put into a letter. I recommend having a dot phrase so you can quickly jot them in, but you can submit that off. And sometimes it does work and it does get covered. The one other thing I'm going to mention is that some of these medications are now affordable out of pocket for some families. And there's ways to do that that makes it even more affordable. But just for the intro level, right now, semaglutide under brand name Wegovy, and actually this is the same cost as Ozempic, which is the type 2 brand, type 2 diabetes brand, they are $200 out of pocket for the first 1 to 2 months, and then they increase to $350 thereafter. For Saxenda, I think it's around the same price. And again, those prices change on the regular. For the oral Wegovy, which is 18 and up, it's $150 a month out of pocket. And then for Qsymia, which is an oral medication, again, it's about $80 to $90 a month. So for some families, using the out-of-pocket way is a good choice for them. The other thing is that if they don't have GLP-1 coverage, it's not a reason to not treat them. In fact, that's probably even more of a reason, because a lot of the people that don't have GLP-1 coverage may be on Medicaid, and that population is at even higher risk of comorbidities in some cases. So that's a really important population to treat. And in that case, it's not that you restrict them from using anti-obesity medications, it's that you use the oral forms. So Topamax, Vyvanse, Metformin, they're all covered by insurance, regardless of diagnosis code, essentially. Phentermine is not going to be covered, but out of pocket, it's $5 to $25 a month. So they can typically afford an oral medication.
And I am really glad that we're talking about affordability here, because one thing that we like to do on the podcast is also kind of acknowledge the health disparities that exist. And I feel like especially with weight management, affordability, as you talked about, I think it's something that comes up a lot with these medications.
So before we kind of wrap up finally, I'm sure a lot of families want to know about long-term side effects. Okay, I'm putting my kid on this drug. What do we know about these things? Do you know anything about long-term side effects? How do you counsel them? Any risks, benefits, anything that we should know? And it's okay to say, look, we don't really know what's going on right now, and we'll all follow the data together.
We do not know of any significant long-term side effects at this point with GLP-1s. All of the data sort of point to they may be helpful to decrease inflammation and long-term risk of other conditions, but the data is very, very lacking because they just haven't been in use long enough. In terms of all the medications we have access to, some of the oral medications have been used a long time, so we have good safety data there, but for the GLP-1s, we just don't have it. This is one of the reasons that I avoid starting medications unless I have a very good reason to do that, like we discussed earlier in terms of the guidelines I personally use to start pharmacotherapy in most cases, because we know the risks of severe obesity. We may not know the risks of these GLP-1s yet, but we know the risks of severe obesity or of the comorbidity they already have or the high risk of the family history. So in my mind, the unknown risks of the GLP-1 do not outweigh the risks of the comorbidity or the severe obesity. And so that's how I sort of reason that this is an appropriate thing to start.
All right. So we're getting close to running out of time now. So I think the last question I'm going to ask before we do a wrap-up question is, like, is there anything else you want our listening audience, the Grand Rounds folks here, the people at home, what is there anything else if you had, like, your dying breath, last things you want us to know about GLP-1s? what would you want us to know?
Things have taken a turn. I think I'm going to go back to what I said in the beginning. You do not have to be perfect to make progress. And I tell this to my patients all of the time because they get so disheartened when things aren't going as quickly as they want or they didn't see the progress they want. You really don't have to be perfect to make progress. It is about small steps in the right direction. So if you are a practitioner thinking about starting pharmacotherapy or starting a lifestyle group, don't worry, you're not perfect. Start low, go slow, start with what you have available to you, and go from there. It's okay if you're not perfect. It's okay if you don't know everything. It's okay if things go slow. You can do it. Baby steps are the way.
Excellent. All right. We're going to get some questions from the audience because we don't ever get to do this on a live show. Dr. Feldman's got a question.
I had two questions. One is, Stevie, when you start your patients out on the GLP-1s, do you set expectations that they're going to be on these medications for the rest of their life? What's that discussion like? And what's the hope for the patient over time? And then two, these medications certainly are saturating the adult primary care world. Do you think that pediatric primary care docs should be feeling comfortable prescribing these as well? Or does everyone need to come see Stevie?
Okay, so to answer your first question, I try to avoid the word lifelong. I think that's a triggering word to families, but I will say long-term. And the other reason is because we don't know if it's lifelong. What we know is that if a GLP-1 medication is working well for you and you stop it, the BMI will typically go back up. Not entirely to where it was before. So for example, if you lost 20%, you might go back up to a loss of 5%. But you do have regain. And so I talk about that with families. We are treating an underlying metabolic dysregulation. So if that medication that helped that dysregulation is removed, that dysregulation presents itself again and the weight goes back up. In terms of why I don't use the word lifelong, not only is it triggering, but also there are medications that may be coming out in the near future that help reset that BMI set point so that they can come off of the GLP-1s. Also, they may be a candidate for bariatric surgery in the future. Not to say they wouldn't, even at this moment we're starting the GLP-1, but they may want to do bariatric surgery in the future. So that may change what medications they use. And then in terms of the maintenance phase, even though they may need to be in the long term, sometimes we can switch to a different medication that's an oral medication for long term. But in general, if you're using a weight management medication and it's had significant benefit for you, you're going to need to use it, something like it, long term, or have some intervention as of now. But stay tuned for 5 to 10 years from now, because there are some things coming up. The other question, primary care. So I'm going to leave my personal opinion out of it. I'm going to go to the guidelines. The guidelines say American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that this care take place in the primary care setting as much as possible and then refer to the subspecialist. The truth is there are not enough subspecialists that are doing this. There's just not. So in order to make this effective and therapeutic and not practice the watchful waiting approach, but to practice the intervention approach, we have to get primary care doctors to feel comfortable with these medications.
Great. Thank you so much. I had a question. There's a lot of online chatter about microdosing GLP-1s, and I'm curious about your take and if there's any pediatric data to support it.
Data? Probably not. But use? Yes. And microdosing, I have been doing more frequently since the cost, the out-of-pocket cost has gone down for these medications. So you can do microdosing. It takes a lot of personal education to do it and a lot of education of your patient as well, depending on the medication you're using to microdose. Wegovy is the hardest one to microdose because it comes in a single dose pen that's not clickable. So that requires vial syringe method to microdose Wegovy. The other medications like tirzepatide or Ozempic, these versions of these medications are clickable, so they're easier to microdose. Microdosing can be really helpful if you have a young child or you have a person that has really severe side effects, even at the low dose. You can start at a lower dose and go up. I also have patients that dose twice a week instead of once a week. So they basically cut their dose in half and give half on a Friday and half on a Tuesday. And that works better for them in terms of side effects. You can only do that if you're microdosing.
And just to follow up, what about when they're in quote unquote remission or have reached a goal? Do you ever suggest like any form of micro or spacing out dosings instead of weekly?
Yeah, I think if they have reached a weight plateau and they've been in that, it's a good goal for them. Let's say it's a 10 to 20% improvement in BMI. The weight has plateaued. They're doing great. Lifestyle is doing great. There's no upcoming start of college happening. Then that's a great time to sort of maybe trial at the lower dose and wean down very slowly. Again, just thinking about long-term side effects, we don't know. And most side effects are dose related. So if you can get somebody to a lower dose and it's still a safe place for them, that's always the way I try to go.
My question is about the kind of compounded GLP-1s that are out there from like a lot of these different websites that people can sign up for. What is the harm of those, of getting kind of medications that way? Do you see patients going that route because affordability is really hard? And how should we counsel our patients if they're asking about them?
So I think the counseling is probably the first part, and it's that the compounding medications are not as FDA regulated as the others. So there may not be out-of-house testing to make sure that that is the actual dose they're getting. The other issue is that a lot of these medications come vial syringe method with very minimal guidance given. And because it's not the doctor prescribing it, it can be hard to let them know, okay, this is what you're going to see on the syringe. It's this many milliliters. This is the dose. Because if they're compounding it, they are changing the concentration of the medication and they're adding something else to it, most likely, like B12. It may be a benign addition, but that schematic makes it really hard to work with these medications for most families. There are some families that are really good at doing this sort of thing, but even then, you need to have the conversation with them. Even if they choose to use a compounded medication, they need to have very regular follow-up with you so that you can guide the dose changes, not what is on the label of the medication, which is actually a very dangerous rate of increase of doses. So they need to have a conversation with you. I don't prescribe to compounding pharmacies because it's illegal, from what I understand. But there are other doctors that will do it, or there's other ways for patients to get it. the online pharmacies have shifted. So now, I'm not going to name names because this could change as time goes on, but there are online pharmacies that have, you know, visit-oriented apps or nutrition-oriented apps. Those pharmacies are actually moved away from compounded medications. And as of within the last 6 to 12 months, they are giving the manufacturer medication. They are just getting it from the manufacturer and providing that. So it's no longer compounded. So in those cases, it's great. So guidance, pharmacy, yeah. Oh, safety. I don't think anyone has any data because they've not been studied because they're not legal. But theoretically, if you're dosing it correctly and it is the right dose of the medication, it would theoretically be safe, but there's no way to guarantee that's what you're getting.
Yeah, so I am just monitoring the chat on the Zoom. The one question that still hasn't been answered from the chat yet is, how do you handle this when a patient is fasting for Ramadan?
This is a really tricky one. And Ramadan is actually a time that's really dangerous for a lot of the patients I work with. And sometimes they need medical exemption from prolonged fasting because it's just not safe. So with a GLP-1, and this gets into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty of how to deal with side effects that may need to be its own podcast, but you actually feel more nausea the longer you don't eat on a GLP-1. And so one of the ways of dealing with nausea or vomiting is actually to have more frequent but smaller meals. So if you're having a very prolonged fast, you may have worse side effects on the GLP-1. On the other side, if you don't take your GLP-1 and you enter a fasting period that's very long, a lot of the patients I work with have severe binge eating afterwards from the excess hunger. I have even had patients that have had self-harm because they were so hungry during this fasting period. So I think you need to have a very kind and empathetic conversation with patients about what to expect and if it's safe for that person. There are other ways that we can practice our religious faith that may not be medically harmful to us. And so we need to come up with some boundaries there. And it may look like Ramadan, it may look like fasting, and maybe it's just a little bit different for that particular person.
All right. Well, thank you. So before we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to plug? You want our audience to know about?
I do have a program that I'm always seeking new families for. It's called Healthy Families. It got mentioned earlier, but this is my baby program that I love. I have this culinary medicine program that I do because so many patients have come to me saying they didn't know how to make their favorite smoothie, or they didn't know how to make a quesadilla with black beans, even though it was their favorite thing to eat, or they didn't know how to make a black bean bowl from Chipotle, which is like the cheapest thing you can make. So I have this idea to start this culinary medicine class, which is an intensive lifestyle therapy program that we do here at Hopkins every other Thursday. We are currently enrolling. If you want to send anybody between the age of 5 and 18 that has a BMI of the 95th percentile, there is virtually no restrictions. You can have any medical diagnosis as long as you're willing to work as a family in the group.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes on our website at www.cribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. And a special thanks to our producer for this show, Dr. Joan Park, and our wonderful social media team, which is mostly Denise Cruz and X Blue Sky on Instagram. And I've been Sam Mazur.
I'm Joan.
And this has been Chris the Two-Man Chew. Thank you. Good night. Bye.